Thanks for tuning in for the November 16th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. In this week's feature interview, Dr. Anthony Lang talks about the AN practice guideline on dopaminergic therapy for motor symptoms in early Parkinson's disease. In our What's Trending segment, Dr. Amanda Guidon discusses the development of consensus disease definitions for the neurologic adverse events associated with the use of immune checkpoint inhibitors.
Hey, this is Jason Crowell from Norton Neuroscience Institute, and today I'm talking to Tony Lang. Tony is a movement disorder specialist at the University of Toronto, and today we're discussing an AAN practice guideline summary that was published this week in the journal Neurology on dopaminergic therapy for motor symptoms in early Parkinson's disease. Tony, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to, Jason.
So before we discuss the specific recommendations from this subcommittee, I thought it would be useful if we just step back for a minute and talk about why we're even discussing this issue in the first place. So, you know, obviously we have several different medications available to treat motor symptoms in patients with Parkinson's disease. This is not an all-encompassing list, but there's levodopa, there are dopamine agonists like ropinirole, pramipexole, and reticotine. There are MAO-B inhibitors like selegiline, risagiline, and cefenamide. Tony, just to begin with, could you first provide some historical perspective about which drugs have typically been used early in the course of Parkinson's disease and how this pendulum has swung over time?
Sure. Well, levodopa is the longest available dopaminergic medication for Parkinson's, and we've always known it's very effective. However, over many years, there was a belief that levodopa could in fact be toxic to remaining dopaminergic neurons. There was a phase where oxidative stress was really highlighted as a principal pathogenic mechanism, and the increased dopamine turnover from levodopa was believed to drive this even further and therefore could increase the damage to the remaining dopaminergic neurons. So there was a time during this phase where delaying levodopa therapy, almost at all costs, was an approach that many neurologists followed. Then we had a phase where concerns related to levodopa-induced dyskinesias drove a series of clinical trials comparing dopamine agonists to levodopa. And fairly regularly, or in almost all of the trials that were done, it was shown that dopamine agonists were associated with less incidence of dyskinesia than levodopa. So we have a concern about a toxic effect of levodopa and an advantage of dopamine agonists in being associated with fewer dyskinesia. And then finally, the monoamine oxidase B inhibitors were felt potentially to be disease modifying, both maybe by reducing dopamine metabolism, but particularly by altering apoptosis and other protective mechanisms. So for all these reasons, the best drug that we have for Parkinson's was being delayed and not used. And in fact, these issues encouraged what was called a levodopa phobia. Physicians and patients concerned about the toxic effect of the drugs or the side effect of levodopa were afraid of using the most potent drug for Parkinson's disease. So that's the historical background. And then over the last many years, we've begun to recognize that levodopa still was quite effective, that in fact the development of motor complications was more related to the severity and duration of the disease than to the duration of treatment. And the dopamine agonists in particular had a very large list of side effects that hadn't been recognized previously, particularly excessive daytime sleepiness and most notably impulse control disorders. So the whole field was in a bit of a state of disarray. And so it was really important to establish guidelines based on all the evidence that we have.
Terrific. That's really helpful. So let's start with efficacy. In individuals with early Parkinson's disease, how does levodopa compare to the agonist or MAO-B inhibitors for treatment of motor symptoms?
Well, there's absolutely no question that levodopa is most effective. Dopamine agonists can be useful and provide very significant improvement in early Parkinson's. However, levodopa still remains more potent and more effective than the dopamine agonist, and certainly far more effective than MAO-B inhibition, which provides really mild to modest benefit at best.
Great. So what about side effect profiles? Are adverse effects more common or more bothersome in one of these categories of medications compared to the other?
Well, certainly the adverse effect profile does differ. So monoamine oxidase B inhibitors are usually quite well tolerated. Some patients do have varying side effects, but in general, they are well tolerated and patients manage well. But as I've mentioned, the efficacy profile is far more limited. The dopamine agonists, on the other hand, cause hallucinations more frequently than levodopa, excessive daytime sleepiness, and the impulse control disorders. I should also say edema, lower limb edema, not infrequently as well. The impulse control disorders really set the dopamine agonists aside. So pathological gambling, shopping, binge eating, hypersexuality, and others, but those are the four main impulse control disorders, are far more common with dopamine agonists than with levodopa. The main impulse control disorder that's been well described with levodopa is hypersexuality. The others are very infrequent. And so these problems are extremely common with dopamine agonists. The initial studies showed a relatively low incidence, but clearly a relationship between the impulse control disorders and dopamine agonists. But more recently, 40% plus of patients followed over time treated with dopamine agonists can develop impulse control disorders. Finally, on the other hand, levodopa is far more commonly associated with motor fluctuations. So the development of wearing off and motor variability from on to off, as well, most importantly, the development of levodopa-induced dyskinesia. And there is a very clear, much higher incidence of dyskinesia with levodopa than there is with dopamine agonists. Despite that, though, the patients still do better on levodopa, even when they have dyskinesia, than they do with either dopamine agonists or with monoamine oxidase B inhibition with respect to their Parkinsonian symptomatic benefit.
And obviously, many in our audience will know that there's increasingly different formulations of levodopa, different controlled release formulations. Is there evidence to suggest that I should choose immediate release over one of these controlled release formulations?
Not really. The evidence is still lacking. Certainly compared to the old controlled release Sinemet, there is no advantage at all of using that drug over immediate release levodopa. And as the disease progresses and people get gastric emptying problems and a variety of other difficulties with the intake and absorption of levodopa, controlled release levodopa is associated, the old controlled release Sinemet is associated with far more irregular bioavailability. So most of us now do not initiate treatment with controlled release Sinemet. We use it in the evening before bed in patients with nocturnal akinesia, where it's less important to have very reliable pharmacokinetics. But during the day, there is no advantage. And in fact, there was a study years ago showing that dyskinesia were no more or less common with controlled release levodopa. With the other mixed levodopa formulations, such as Rytary, which is available in the United States, but not in other jurisdictions, there is no evidence that supports the early use of that treatment to prevent the development of motor complications. Once patients do develop motor fluctuations, wearing off, for example, they may do better with Rytary, but there isn't any reason to think that they should be started on that drug in preference to immediate release levodopa. At least the evidence doesn't exist now.
Terrific. Tony, I was curious if you'd be willing to take us in the exam room, so to speak. And I'm interested what you say to patients when they have early Parkinson's disease and you've made the diagnosis and they're asking you about, you know, what medicine should I start? What would you recommend? I'm curious, how do you frame that conversation?
Well, first, it's really important to inform patients of the progressive nature of Parkinson's and the fact that none of our treatments currently have proven disease-modifying effects. I generally explain to them the difference between a disease-modifying therapy and a symptomatic therapy. My analogy is strep throat, and I remind them that streptococcal sore throat is a bacterial infection that results in pharyngitis, a pain in the throat, with the main symptom being that. I tell them that we don't have a penicillin-like drug for Parkinson's disease that would be curative of a strep throat and or changing the course of the disease. Instead, we have very good lozenges for Parkinson's. So if all you have is a sore throat independent of the cause, if you had an effective lozenge, you improve the symptoms, you don't change the underlying disease process. And they get that. They understand the difference between symptomatic and disease modifying. And then I go through the symptomatic therapies. And depending on the age of the patient, associated clinical features such as mild cognitive impairment or more significant cognitive disturbances, a pre-existing history of impulse control-like behaviors like addictions, or a family history of alcoholism and other addictions, I discuss the various available symptomatic therapies on those bases. I should preface all these remarks by saying, if we are doing clinical trials, I think it's really important to try to enroll patients in useful clinical trials that will get us some answers that we don't have now. So we have clinical trials of disease-modifying therapies as well as clinical trials of symptomatic drugs. And so if at all possible, we try to enroll patients into scientific studies. In the case of someone whose quality of life is substantially impacted, who really needs to be better, whether it's because their golf handicap has gone down the toilet and they've retired to play golf and that's their one love, whether it's that or it's the fact that they have impairment in their function and day-to-day life, their activities of daily living, I still ask about quality of life and what's important to them. And if their quality of life is negatively impacted, it's now time to start symptomatic therapy. If it's not, then we might enroll them into a disease-modifying trial. And so then what we do is we go through, as I've mentioned, age and concomitant factors. If I have a very, very young patient in the 40s or 50s, I will talk to them about the possibility of starting a dopamine agonist. If the symptoms are extremely mild, we might use a monoamine oxidase B inhibitor to begin with. Some patients really are hoping for disease-modifying effects, and there is still some slight uncertainty about the monoamine oxidase B inhibitor effects, so they might want to start that. And I wouldn't decline or deny them that, but I really do emphasize the evidence for disease modification with MAOB inhibition is almost negligible. So if they need something more potent and they're very young, as I say, we might consider a dopamine agonist. If they are 60 or above, I really feel that levodopa is the drug that we would use. And if we're going to even consider a dopamine agonist, it takes an awful long time to discuss that. It's important to talk to someone who can help monitor some of the behaviors that I and many of my colleagues have had patients even lie to us about. So, for example, someone who is gambling, very commonly they will not admit this to you, and they've lost even hundreds of thousands of dollars. Young men with hypersexuality, I've had young men decline or deny my questions about this, and then only weeks later call me in a panic, telling me that they're afraid of being a sex addict. So impulse control disorders are a very, very important concern that you have to discuss quite extensively with patients before you start therapy. And then finally, when you start levodopa, you have to explain to them the occurrence of motor fluctuations, the very, very common development of dyskinesia, the fact that this really relates to the severity of the disease and not the fact that you've started the drug, but that drug is indeed causative. And so you need to get them knowledgeable about dyskinesia and comfortable about the fact that these are a common side effect.
Terrific, Tony. I really like the pharyngitis analogy to distinguish between symptomatic treatment and disease-modifying treatment. And that was a really useful review of which type patients you would consider which type therapy. Any other thoughts before we wrap up here?
Well, also, I find it very helpful to inform patients of a couple of additional bits of literature. One is a nice study comparing patients in Italy and in Africa that found and helped confirm the fact that the development of motor complications, particularly dyskinesia, truly related to the severity of the underlying disease. So this occurred far earlier after levodopa was started in Africa than in Italy, because levodopa was delayed to a much more severe stage in Africa. It wasn't available as readily, and the diagnosis didn't come as early in patients from Africa. I also tell patients about a little study we did where we did a questionnaire of patients with Parkinson's disease who had not been treated yet or who were treated but didn't have dyskinesia, and then compared their results to patients who had already developed dyskinesia. And in the first two groups, patients really wanted us to delay the development of dyskinesia, do everything we could to avoid the problem, even to the point of undertreating their Parkinson's. Whereas the patients who had dyskinesia regularly said, this isn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. And I really prefer to have dyskinesia than have those off symptoms that I know I have when the dyskinesia goes away. I'm far more functional when I have the dyskinesia. I also remind people, because they've often seen Michael J. Fox on television with dyskinesia, and that's their marker that they want to avoid. And I remind them how highly functional Michael J. Fox is, despite having dyskinesia for probably over 20 years. He's still working, he's still producing, he's still writing, and that's despite a problem that these patients are afraid of. And so that helps reassure them somewhat as well.
Really great reminders here, and really a great reminder of perhaps just often sticking with what we know is the best with levodopa. And, you know, it's been around for a long time and sounds like should still be our mainstay of treatment, if I hear everything you're saying correctly.
Very much so. Yep.
Terrific. Well, again, I've been speaking with Tony Lang from the University of Toronto. We've been discussing the AAN Guidelines Subcommittee Practice Summary published in this week's issue of the Journal of Neurology. It's titled Dopaminergic Therapy for Motor Symptoms in Early Parkinson's Disease. Tony, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your thoughts.
Glad to help. Take care.
I'm Kate Neville, and I'm a neuro-oncologist at Indiana University. Today, I'm interviewing Amanda Guidon at Mass General. We are going to discuss a paper published in the Journal for Immunotherapy of Cancer titled Consensus Disease Definitions for Neurologic Immune-Related Adverse Events of Immune Checkpoint Inhibitors. Thanks so much, Amanda, for talking with me today about your paper. I'm really excited to talk about this topic, especially as a neuro-oncologist. This is something that is referred to me with this question quite a bit, so I'm excited about your paper and to talk about it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Catherine, and thanks so much for the invitation to be here.
Before we talk about the main finding of your paper, can you please explain why your paper might make us better neurologists?
Sure. In designing this project, you know, our goal was to improve diagnosis and characterization of neurologic immune-related adverse events from immune checkpoint inhibitor therapy for cancer. We know that this is an increasingly common referral, and these patients can be really complicated. And we wanted to develop a common language and accessible framework, you know, which everyone could use, neurologists, oncologists, advanced practice providers on the front line, and community and academic providers and researchers as well. And so we know that early diagnosis and treatment of neurologic immune-related adverse events leads to better neurologic outcomes and maybe possibly better cancer outcomes. I really think this paper will help clinicians understand and work through these complex toxicities, and then hopefully better understand and treat what they're seeing at the bedside.
Yeah, that's great. Could you tell us a little bit about the design of the study and how you defined and reached consensus for these definitions?
Sure, absolutely. So this was really a collaborative group effort and an iterative process over a couple years from start to finish. And a core group drafted the definitions, the severity criteria, and then the general statements. Once we had these draft definitions, we invited members of a larger multi-institutional and multi-specialty panel to participate. And as many listeners are probably familiar with, it was a modified Delphi consensus process. We had two rounds of anonymous ratings by panelists and two virtual face-to-face meetings to discuss areas of controversy. And we really had, you know, good representation from clinicians at researchers at many major centers involved in this work. All in all, we had 27 panelists from 15 academic medical centers, and we voted on 53 rating scales. our real primary goal was usability, appropriateness, and accuracy. And that's what everyone voted on the 9-point scales in an electronic survey format. And we gave the opportunity to provide free text comments as well, which were very, very useful from the panel. We aggregated survey responses and incorporated those into revised definitions. And then consensus was based on numeric ratings with pre-specified definitions. We really weren't sure, you know, how many statements were going to achieve consensus, but remarkably, 77% received first round consensus. And then after revisions on the second round, all items received consensus.
Yeah, that's just great. That sounds like such a detailed process that you went through to include all the key players in going over these definitions and really creating definitions the clinical neurologist, oncologist, and other care providers can use, hopefully in clinical practice and research. So could you briefly, which I know is really hard to do because there was so much that you covered in this paper, but could you briefly list the core syndromes that you define and helpful information in those definitions to the practicing neurologist?
Sure, absolutely. So we really wanted flexibility in the definitions to start broad and get more and more specific as the diagnostic information is available. And that is meant to follow the patient through evaluation as they might go, let's say, from the oncologist to the neurologist and back. And the first distinction is whether the patient is having a neurologic immune-related adverse event and whether it's affecting the central nervous system or peripheral nervous system. That we are hoping could be, you know, ascertained potentially by the oncologist even before they see neuro, though sometimes not. And then the neurologist comes in the next part and identifies a patient with one of the 7 core syndromes. And we defined 4 central nervous system syndromes and 3 peripheral nervous system syndromes. The 4 CNS syndromes are immune-related meningitis, encephalitis, demyelinating disease, and vasculitis. And the 3 PNS syndromes are neuropathy, neuromuscular junction disorder, or myopathy. For each core syndrome, we then identified 6 descriptors to really flesh out the phenotypic variability of the syndromes. So those are syndrome subtype. So for example, a patient might have an immune-related neuropathy and then their syndrome subtype is AIDP or Guillain-Barré syndrome. Antibody association is the 2nd. Level of certainty of the diagnosis, severity, and whether this is a de novo presentation or an exacerbation of pre-existing disease, and then concurrent or overlapping immune-related adverse events. And there's a flowchart outlining this framework in the paper of the 2 general branches, the 7 core syndromes, and then the 6 descriptors.
Yeah, and I love the tables. I think that particularly the section on diagnostic certainty is really a potential, really helpful tool for neurologists and oncologists, as it creates between definite, probable, and possible a really nice framework for people to go off of.
Yeah, we wanted the tables to be useful and easy to reference, for clinicians for the particular syndrome.
What are some of the limitations of this paper?
Well, you know, you were talking about diagnostic certainty, and we thought that was very important to emphasize in the definitions. You know, some of these patients, for whatever reason, maybe related to their cancer prognosis or otherwise, might not undergo all of the workup required to reach certain diagnostic certainty. But we just wanted to, you know, emphasize it is a slight limitation, though very common in neurologic disease definitions, that the diagnostic certainty is not directly linked to treatment decisions. So the panel would generally treat probable and sometimes even possible neurologic immune-related adverse events. We divided it to really maximize the accuracy of the definitions and to prevent misclassification of the definite patients. So that is, you know, one, I don't know if it's a limitation, but just something to be aware of. Another limitation is that, you know, at the end of the process, there were some areas which reached consensus, but still had debate, such as the immune-related demyelinating disease and immune-related encephalitis categories, and whether these definitions would be better as primarily anatomic descriptions, since sometimes the underlying pathophysiology is unknown. So we, you know, address this in the paper, and we think that if the disease definitions are revised, that this might be an area that could be improved in the future. And there are most likely limitations, you know, really that we haven't thought of or haven't discovered yet that we'll identify through using it more. And we're always welcome to feedback on how to possibly improve them for a future iteration. And, you know, we plan to do work to evaluate the definitions themselves and look at concurrence with clinical diagnosis as well.
I really enjoyed reading this paper, and I definitely plan to use your takeaways in my patient care, especially these tables. And everyone listening, please be sure that you look up Dr. Guidon's paper in the Journal for Immunotherapy of Cancer. Thank you.
Thanks, Catherine.
This is Jose Merino. Don't forget to check out Neurology's three subspecialty journals, Neurology Genetics, Neurology Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice, as well as our mini-sites on Equity, Diversity and Inclusion, Global Neurology, and Innovations in Care Delivery. Please check out this week's journal. It features an article investigating the association between age at onset of multiple sclerosis, brain gray matter volume, and white matter microstructural abnormalities, as well as a study that explores the impact of having a sustained research topic and methodology on physician scientists' career success. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.